Under today is State of Minnesota versus, I believe it's pronounced Iwin. Council will correct me if I'm wrong about the pronunciation. Council, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions indicated in the light and clock in the center podium. You can use either of the three, actually either the center podium or the one that's closest to you. If you have any health concerns, obviously you want to use the one closest to you. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Lance Iwin. The issue on this appeal is whether it was proper for the jury to convict my client based on constructive possession of the methamphetamine that was discovered in his vehicle at the scene. Under the standard of review that I have presented and am relying on, the question is whether there is the allowance for a reasonable hypothesis other than guilt. A reasonable hypothesis, conclusion, that my client didn't possess the methamphetamine that was in his car along with his passenger. I will present today that it is also apparently reasonable to ask whether my client even knew the methamphetamine was in his vehicle. What we have as far as what transpired at the scene is pretty much just the testimony of the deputy that performed the vehicle search and spoke to my client at the scene, Deputy Kiesling. I just would want to emphasize Deputy Kiesling's own observations at the scene, that he found my client to be both cooperative and genuine. My client admitted immediately that the roach that was on the console that apparently blew away in the wind, which I don't question, was his.
Can I take you to the most troublesome part, at least from my perspective, for your client's appeal on this issue? Your client made a claim for the $3,000 in cash that was found in the small container that also contained the methamphetamine. I'm trying to get my mind around why isn't that enough to conclude that the only reasonable inference is that your client possessed. That's the bag your client was referring to. What was in that bag belonged to your client. Your client at least possessed everything in that bag. Help disabuse me of that presumption.
If I can. But I'll begin by stating that the amount that my client claimed in the statement of claim form that was admitted at trial was not the amount that was established as a result of the police search. It did differ.
Slightly.
It differed slightly, yes.
I mean, there's no other place in the car where there was a sum of another bundle of $3,000 or so elsewhere.
Well, that I take issue with.
Okay.
The record is clear that Deputy Kiesling did not search every container in the vehicle. In fact, it appears that the only containers that he searched were the backpack that was unquestionably the passenger's, Mr. Borkowski, and the G-bag.
So there might have been another $3,000 lying somewhere in the car that was never found?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Is that reasonable?
My client stated that his own bags were in the vehicle as well. They weren't searched. Deputy Kiesling didn't even take a photograph of the back seat. All we have is a photograph of the front compartment with Mr. Borkowski's backpack on the passenger seat. But that is clearly in the record. My client said that he had a duffel bag and a black bag that had his stuff in it. He also said at the scene that everything he had was in that car, but his bags were not searched.
So I just to be clear, So then you believe it's a reasonable inference that some other bundle of $3,000 was there in the tool bag, perhaps, of your client?
I do, and...
Are there, beyond speculation, is there any conversation, any statement, any testimony that would lead us to find support for that?
Yes, the statement of claim form. My client said that he had an exact amount of money in the car, and presumably it was still in the car because, again, Deputy Kiesling didn't search my client's own bags. They weren't even taken into evidence. So they were presumably left in the vehicle along with the other things he said he saw, like a toolbox. That wasn't admitted into evidence. Deputy Kiesling appears to not even have searched the center console compartment or the glove compartment. So the reasonableness arises from the fact that my client didn't just own the vehicle. He had all of his clothing and other items apparently in his own bags in there. They weren't searched, Your Honor. Mr. Iwin was not the only person capable of possessing $3,000 or $4,000, however much it was.
He did seem to say in one of his statements that the only item belonging to his passenger was the backpack.
See, I take issue with that as well. Respondent has contended that, though changing my client's words, I went through that in detail, I hope, in my reply brief, that what my client said was Mr. Borkowski probably had a bag. Okay, if we're going to rely on words that were literally given, and this is from the deputy, so we're going to assume they're true, okay, in the rules of English grammar, a is literally the indefinite article. What I gathered from my client's statements at the scene was that he was not entirely sure what Mr. Borkowski brought into the vehicle.
But if you say he probably had a bag.
Yes.
Rather than he probably had bags, that would tend to indicate singular.
I won't dispute that it can lead to that inference. What I'm contending here is that it could lead to the inference that my client didn't actually keep track of what Mr. Borkowski brought into the vehicle. He didn't even want to say that the backpack, which was clearly Mr. Borkowski's because of the large size clothing, and it was Mr. Borkowski's. I mean, please remember, my client was at the scene and he watched Mr. Borkowski run away. So that has to factor into the analysis here. I mean, the cases of constructive possession or just circumstantial evidence where this court has concluded that the only reasonable inference is guilt have been where there have been some kind of inculpatory circumstances, like an admission from the defendant or contraband by or on his person, such as in the German case or the Florine case. But I think that perspective has to apply to the other people in the car, too. I mean, that's what was done in Sam and Harris. In Harris, the gun butt was sticking out of the sunroof compartment right over the driver's head. Yet this court concluded that it was reasonable to allow for the possibility he didn't even know it was there.
Let's go back just a minute. Something came to my mind, if you don't mind me taking you off track a bit. Back to the money. You say that the amounts were different.
They were.
There was $3,002 found in the bag and then another $400 elsewhere, which totaled around $3,402. Your client claimed $3,498. Relatively close.
Yes, Your Honor.
Only $98 different, $90 or so different. How does that, the similarity of those two quantities fit your argument that there was $3,498.91 somewhere else in the Tahoe?
Well, I'm not going to try to argue now to deny the similarity of the figures. I can only rest on the fact that I believe the witnesses who testified weren't actually sure of the exact amount that came out of the G-bag. It was in the neighborhood of that amount. And I seem to recall that my client claimed something more in the neighborhood of $4,000, but perhaps I'm mistaken on that. But
I think I'm looking at the form, at least as it's presented, a copy of it in the brief, $3,498.91.
Then I will defer to that, Your Honor. But I can then respond by saying that under the circumstantial evidence test, one single circumstance cannot be looked at in isolation. I think that that circumstance has to be informed by the fact that Mr. Iwin's own possessions were not searched, and that Mr. Borkowski was the one at the scene who acted like he had guilty knowledge of something. That has to matter here. It seems like the jury didn't even consider that. I mean, we don't know from Deputy Kiesling that he did any kind of a warrant search at the scene. I mean, what other reason was there for Mr. Borkowski to run away like that?
What other reason? Well, what if they're both involved in drug dealing? What if he's concerned that the police might suspect that they're both involved in drug dealing, not just drug possession with all the sum of money? I mean, there are other...
Yes.
I mean, if we're looking at the totality of possibilities, joint possession is also a consideration.
Well, which the district
Which would explain why he's running.
Which the district court expressly excluded from the instructions given to the jury, making the finding of fact that it was not applicable in this case.
Mr. Marabili, respondents arguing that it doesn't really matter what instructions were given to the jury, that on appeal we can sort of stand back and consider theories maybe that were not submitted to the jury, such as the joint possession theory. I'm just wondering if you could address that a little bit.
I think that assuming that that's how it is and that's how this court will analyze this case.
Well, do you agree with that, I guess, first and foremost?
I don't.
Okay,
I presented
why
in,
not?
Because I presented anyway in my brief that the law presented to the jury should be the law of the case, that it's not really fair to the parties, particularly the appellant, to have his case analyzed under a significantly wider factual scenario than the jury was actually presented with. The jury decided this case on whether my client possessed the drugs or not, not whether he could have possessed them jointly. The only other thing I can add, Your Honor, is that if all of what you're saying is going to be applied here, I still feel that the weight of the circumstances tend to point either towards the passenger's guilt, possession of this methamphetamine, or, like I said, that Mr. Iwin did not know that the drugs were in his vehicle. So that would not get the conviction upheld under the joint possession theory either. I just don't see how it can be ignored that my client at the scene confessed to having the roach and then said that everything I have is in that vehicle. I know that there have been other cases where a police officer will ask the defendant in the vehicle, do you have any drugs in there? And they say no, and then of course they find drugs. Well, this is kind of the inversion of that. Deputy Kiesling kept his questions open-ended, and my client just said everything in there is mine except for whatever Borkowski had. His statements at the scene, according to the deputy, just do not convey a guilty intent or purpose.
Well, I mean, I don't know that we'd be able to count the number of cases, the consent to search cases, for example, where the police stop someone on the highway and it's a mule carrying pounds and pounds of cocaine, and the officer says, you mind if I search? You don't have to let me search. And the defendant says, sure, go ahead, search.
I know.
Search away.
I agree.
So I don't know that the premise of the very smart and consistent suspect on the scene theory fits reality, if that's a basis we presume.
Well, but that's why I'm drawing a distinction here in terms of what was asked and what was said. Okay, this is different than the, are there drugs in your car? No, officer. This is, what's yours in the car? And he said, well, everything I have is in there. I mean, if he actually knew, and you know what, this statement might have even come after the deputy discovered the meth in the G-bag. I don't know. But if he actually knows that there is felony contraband in his vehicle, I think the simpler answer would have just been not everything. He said everything.
Well, but you're talking in the context. As I read the facts the conversation with the officer, it seemed as if your client was not wanting to throw his companion under the bus. And that might explain why. If he knows there's methamphetamine and his only options then would be to say, no, that belongs to him, not me. And it doesn't seem as if that was the tenor of your client's interaction with police.
Well, not even the prosecutor at trial tried to use that statement as my client confessing that the methamphetamine was his. That wasn't the
argument.
Not
as a confession, but just as not intending to point to his friend and say, no, it's not mine, it's his.
I know. If nothing else, then I'll just rely on what Deputy Kiesling relayed about my client's demeanor at the scene, that he appeared to be honest and cooperative and genuine. That's all, Judge.
Now, it seems as if the deputy stuck with that. It seems like the deputy began with that and then later backed away and said, maybe he's not being so honest.
Because he was unfortunately allowed to make what I thought was an objectionable claim that my client was a drug runner, which was completely irrelevant and, you know, not anything to do with a fifth-degree possession charge. And that, for all we know, may have prejudiced the jury. But either way, there's nothing I can do about that. But the case law that I am chiefly relying on here, so I don't know if it's German or Hermann. I'm just going to say German. You know, that's the one where there was meth elsewhere in the car, constructive possession, but he also had some in his wallet, so it was kind of a fluorine issue. But Sam and Harris, okay, I think that the circumstances are similar here. I mean, in particular, Harris. Now, that may not be the equivalent of a roughly similar amount of money that was situated next to the contraband, but it was right over his head. The question is whether any other inferences can be drawn from what was admitted at the scene and what was admitted at trial.
Thank you.
And, my time is up.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I'll let you go over a little bit. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal, and you can continue if you like with that line of reasoning. Counsel for the state. Get your fingers caught in there.
Your Honors, Counsel, my name is Lisa Lodine Peralta. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, State of Minnesota. I understand the court's discussions largely focused on the individual facts of this case. That is what respondent thinks is important. The reply brief of the appellant seemed to focus on why didn't the state address the cases. So I just wanted to address that first. Appellant cited 5 cases where he discussed the facts and, as I have claimed, sort of piecemeal disjointedly discussed the cases. They were the Supreme Court cases in, and now I'm losing my papers. Fluorine is, of course, the oldest one, and we have Cusack in 86, and I'm missing the most recent one. Must be Harris, right? I'm sorry, Harris. So those 3, and then the Court of Appeals cases of German and Sam. And one of the things that I want to point out to you that is absolutely key and why the state moved on to let's just focus on the facts is every single one of those 5 cases, the driver, the defendant, was not the owner of the car. Here, Mr. Iwin owns the car. There is no dispute that, for example, perhaps the items had been left in there by the driver. Perhaps the driver was not laying claim to the items in the car because he didn't own the car.
Why does ownership matter as much in this case? I mean, these things weren't found in the trunk or under the seat or in the dashboard or glove box or in the console. This was a baggy or it's called a bag, sort of a zipper pouch on the back seat. And next to a backpack that belonged to the passenger.
So the reason why it matters is because he does lay claim to almost all of the property that is in the vehicle. And when you add to that the specific fact that he said he had a bag on the bench seat. There were two bags on the bench seat, the bigger backpack, rucksack, duffel bag sort of thing that everybody concedes belonged to Mr. Borkowski, and this other black bag. And so he laid claim to a bag on the back seat bench. There was nothing. So there's a reasonable inference that he's laying claim to that bag. You add to that.
Although he described it differently than it appears. He described it as a black mesh bag.
Right.
How does that factor into our analysis?
Yes. So first of all, no, he could not be specific about describing any of the bags. He suggested that the backpack was a duffel bag or a rucksack. If you look at exhibit four and five, I believe, most people would never describe that bag that way. And so he's not being specific. But the other thing that I would just note when looking at the G bag that, granted, is not made of mesh, is it does resemble like a hygiene bag, some of which are made of different types of material. And so you're right that we can't get beyond the fact that he described a black mesh bag.
What color was the eyeglass or the glasses bag, the small zippered?
That was located inside the black backpack that belonged to Mr. Borkowski. And if you look at the photograph on the seat, it's kind of hard to notice if you're not paying close attention, but you can see an open cover to a wooden box, and the wooden box, and you can see, and this is, of course, this photograph is taken after the deputy has started searching, so it's not located in its exact original location, but you can also see the little black case that, you know, he described as an eyeglass-looking case, but there's no dispute when you look at it that it's a THC kit. And so Mr. Borkowski's backpack had this box. It had its own set of drugs. It had its own set of THC paraphernalia. And so just to touch base with opposing counsel's argument, and I think your discussion, Judge Ross, about what other reason would the passenger have for running away, well, everybody agrees this was his backpack with his size XXXL clothing. He had his own set of drugs in his own bag, so that's a very obvious reason for him wanting to run away, separate from the methamphetamine and the money and the other things that were in the G bag, that we'll call. So you are correct, Judge Gaetis, that the driver described it as a mesh bag. But I think when you look at the totality of the circumstances, the evidence as a whole, there were two bags on the bench seat. One was the backpack that everyone agrees was Borkowski's. The driver indicated he had a bag in the back seat. He described it as black, which it was. He described it as mesh, which it was not. But then you get to the location of the bags. And the small black bag, the G bag, was closer to behind the driver. So that's a key fact. Also, testimony was it was within the wingspan of the driver. And so you have these key facts that place or allow.
Imagine the backseat of a car. I'm guessing, I mean, these are two adult men, that it's probably within the wingspan of both of them. Maybe closer to the driver, but it's probably within the
wingspan of both of them. That is true. But I was pointing out to the actual evidence in the record, so to the extent that there may be an inference that it was reachable by both.
Well, unless he had really short arms, it would have to be reachable by both.
And so I can't dispute if you think that's a reasonable inference. But
I'm just getting to the point, just because it's closer to one than the other, and if the question is it reachable, if that's the issue, and both of them could reach it, I don't know that necessarily excludes one, Mr. Borkowski, and not the defendant.
Okay. So one of the things that is perhaps draws that distinction, besides the money, which I'll get to, is that the Pandora's box with the THC kit had its own set of drugs and baggies and stuff and paraphernalia for smoking THC. This black bag had its own pipe, pipe it was, and its own baggies of crushed pills and this separate container. So this would be an inference that the bags belong to different people. If you've got this wooden Pandora's box with all your drugs and paraphernalia, why would you have a whole nother set of...
There was no meth in the Pandora's box, right? It was only marijuana-related paraphernalia?
Correct. Well...
They're McNeidals, too.
Yes, right? And... So... That's correct, Judge. So let me get to the grand distinction that the defendant wants to place on the amount of money. And you had significant discussion of this. But let's go to the amount. So there isn't a dispute, any reasonable dispute, that there was $3,002 found in the G-bag. Okay? The deputy, Kiesling, said around $3,000 and change. And the other deputy who assisted him in counting the money said he was presented with two lumps of money. And one of the lumps, which he identified from a bag that said the G-bag, his testimony identifies it from the G-bag, he specifically notes the amount was $3,002.
Does the record reveal where the $400 came
from? No, it absolutely does not. And so that's a problem that we all face in terms of trying to account for it. But it does say somewhere around or more than $400. So the fact that there's this $98 or $96 difference is not necessarily significant.
Well, let me ask you this. Would it be a reasonable hypothesis that the statement of claim was consistent with Mr. Iwin making a claim for all of the money that was in the car, whether belonged to him or to his passenger, who is his friend? I mean, is that a reasonable alternative hypothesis?
Well, your reasonable alternative hypothesis that you're asking about is it doesn't negate or dispute in any way whatsoever that there was the $3,002 and that when you look at that amount specifically, it's not reasonable to think that his claim for $3,498 did not include that specific amount. So
the question is, let's assume that Mr. Iwin wants to make a claim. His buddy, Borkowski, says, I'm out my $3,002. And Mr. Iwin says, yeah, I had $400 in there too. So he makes a single claim. I want my truck back. I want my stuff back. I want this money back. You wouldn't necessarily itemize it as belonging to someone else.
Right, but you have to consider reasonable inferences. And you have to consider the totality of the circumstances that are in the record. And the record includes him signing under notary that money belonged to him. And so you can't take that notarized statement of claim of all of that money belonging to him and reasonably, disregard his claim. It is significant evidence in the record.
And to support you, he did say more than that about the money.
Yes.
He says, that I've not been convicted of said crime. The money was what I have left from my savings. So he wasn't actually offering it up for Mr. Borkowski. We'd have to infer more than the record.
Right. That, and that's why I'm saying it's not a reasonable inference, because you just have to jump too far, leaps.
What about the possibility that there's somewhere else in the car, someplace, a bag, not searched, that contains $3,498?
So we know that when they did search, they came up with two lumps of money, one $3,002 and one that was $400+. So it's not a reasonable inference that there's, I don't think, and it's up to your honors to decide. It's not a reasonable inference that his claim to that magic amount of $3,498 did not include those two amounts that were specifically found and that were from, you know, the $3,002 from that G-bag where the methamphetamine
Council,
was located.
Before your time runs out, I'm curious to know how important you think the circumstance proved is that the state claims that Iowan admitted that there was a torch lighter that he admitted ownership of, and that that is something that is perhaps considered to be common for people who smoke meth or want people to smoke meth with, that they have that in their possession.
Absolutely, which is why it's listed in our circumstances proved. And importantly, in distinction, in defense counsel or appellant's counsel distinguishes some other cases where here they're sort of assuming there's no like drug-related evidence found on his person. But when he admits that a butane torch lighter was on his lap and was his, that and the evidence that the investigator put in evidence that they're commonly used for methamphetamine, that's important evidence in the record as a circumstance proved, which makes more of a tie to the methamphetamine than it adds to the inference that he's the owner of the bag.
Although your time's up, I'm going to ask you one additional question and take you over just a bit. So as to the jury instructions, if the district court takes off the table the possibility of joint possession, why would we be able to consider it as a regard when the, if the jury didn't decide that question and we're limited to the circumstances proved, why would we entertain the possibility of joint possession?
So I will be honest and concede here that that is not the argument I intended to make. And so I am not going to urge you to consider that. The attempt I made in the respondent's brief was simply, he's got all this discussion of what the judge said, and my point was that's irrelevant, what the judge said in their conferences.
Right, but you agree as far as circumstances prove, the jury, what the jury decided is what matters in our assessment.
Absolutely, and I think there's evidence in there to suggest the state sort of waived the argument.
Thank you for
joint.
That. Yeah. And thank you. And counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors, Counsel. Under the standard that I am relying on here, the only questions that are asked are how could this money and those drugs have been Mr. Iwan's? That's not following the template from Sam and Harris and German and Florine. The only way the circumstantial evidence test can lead to the conclusion that the guilty verdict can be upheld here is if it is unreasonable to ask if the drugs belong to Mr. Borkowski.
Not unreasonable to ask, unreasonable to conclude.
You're right. If it's unreasonable to get to that conclusion. Let's imagine that I were representing Mr. Borkowski in this appeal. I was representing the defendant who tried to run from the scene, who gave a false name, who had the G-bag right next to his backpack in the back seat. I think I would be in a more untenable position here. Mr. Iwin.
You're pointing at the statement of claim, right? I mean, that would be, if you were representing him, that would be your money argument, right?
I'm just not seeing the statement of claim. I know slam dunk is not the term you would want to use in reviewing circumstantial evidence.
It might be a little close.
Because
here he says, he doesn't, when you say, well, maybe there's some other money somewhere else, he says, I haven't been convicted of said crime. The money was what I have left from my savings. He seems to be focused on the money that was in the bag with the drugs. No?
I'm not seeing that connection because, and I looked back in I had to review my own brief statement of facts. So the state did call the Sergeant Hinton, who wasn't at the scene. Okay, he found some other money in another bag that's unspecified. But it still seems like there were multiple bags and they weren't all searched. But the amount in the G bag was, you know, hundreds less than he claimed. So again, the question here is the G bag, not the same amount in the claim form. If there was 400.
The G bag plus the 400.
Right. But if the 400 was in some other bag, well, then, you know, that, I think, goes to what I've been trying to say here, that there could have been money in other bags. They weren't all searched.
It would be a coincidence, wouldn't it, if there's about $3,400 that's found, and he's making a request for about $3,400 as his.
Well, Your Honor?
It'd be a coincidence that there's some other place in the car where there's $3,400, even though there's no facts that suggest it. I mean, we'd have to be speculating. There's no facts in the record that suggest there's money tucked away somewhere else.
Well, I first don't see the standard under Sam and German and Harris as, you know, requiring the defendant on appeal to present additional facts. I mean, I have to rely on the facts proven here.
Right, but we have, when we look at the record, we can't. We've had a number of cases where we say, well, we don't speculate as to the other possibilities. It's kind of based upon the evidence that was gathered, based upon the circumstances we know. And you're asking us, I mean, no one until the theory that's raised on appeal, do we have this, maybe there's another $3,400 out there.
Every inference, Your Honor, but using that, the literal definition of that word begins as speculation. It is rational when it is supported by evidence.
Well, what is the evidence that would lead to the inference that there's $3,400 somewhere else?
My client's claim. And the fact that not all of his bags were searched. And the fact that he's not the only one that can possess money. And the fact that I didn't mention in my main argument, again, I found the presence of this other vehicle title in the G bag to be quite telling.
What about the fact that we don't know where the $400 came from?
Well, I think that goes more to what I've been saying, Your Honor.
Does it, or does it suggest that they searched other bags? I mean, you want us to conclude that they didn't search the other bags. How do we know that?
Well, it allows for the fact that one other bag might have been searched, but remember, my client said he had two bags. He had a brown duffel bag and a black mesh bag. We don't have it in evidence that they were searched. Their contents were not put into evidence. In fact, the only reference to some other bag was from Sergeant Hinton. We don't know. But the circumstantial evidence test doesn't run out of gas when it's not conclusively pointing to the guilt of another party or away from the guilt of the defendant. It's whether it's reasonable. The attendant circumstances here are what can be attached to the speculation that leads to an inference about Mr. Borkowski. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for your briefing and for your oral argument. Both of you did a very nice job today. We appreciate the opportunity. We're glad we're back live and we can have these conversations in person.